Ben Franklin said, those who are willing to sacrifice essential liberty for a little temporary safety deserve neither. Hi, Scott Horton here for the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's a playing card-sized steel Bill of Rights designed to set off the metal detectors anywhere the police state goes, so you can remind those around you the freedoms we've lost. And for a limited time, get free shipping when you purchase a frequent flyer pack of 5 Bill of Rights Security Edition cards. Play a leading role in the security theater with a Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. The Scott Horton Show is brought to you by the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Join the great Jacob Hornberger and some of the best writers in the libertarian movement like James Bovard, Sheldon Richmond, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more for a real individualist take on the most important matters of peace, liberty, and prosperity in our society. That's the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. If you're like me, then you're right all the time, surrounded by people in desperate need of correction. Well, we can't all have a radio show, but we can all get anti-government propaganda to stick on the back of our trucks. Check out LibertyStickers.com. Categories include anti-war, empire, police state, libertarian, Ron Paul, gun rights, founders quotes, and of course, the stupid election. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Our next guest on the show today is Jeffrey Kay. He writes for truthout.org and Fire Dog Lake. You can find him at Fire Dog Lake as well. This one is called The Forgotten History of David Petraeus. Indeed. Welcome back. How are you doing?
Fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you joining us on the show today. And now, so here's the thing of mine, is that everyone on TV agrees that David Petraeus is the greatest American hero and general since George Washington, and we all love him dearly, and isn't it so sad, like Andrew Mitchell almost started crying, that he accidentally did something wrong and got in trouble for it, but before that, he was the greatest general ever. And the greatest figure in contemporary America, for sure. The greatest American since Mark Twain, at least. So what do you say about that?
Well, it is quite amazing to see the groupie phenomena that Petraeus himself, of course, helped encourage over the years. But actually, David Petraeus was one of a group of neocon war criminals who has been in charge of this country's military and involved in its national security apparatus for some time. And in particular, he was, all of these accolades typically ignore the fact that, as well, he was involved in helping set up what were, in a sense, death squads and terror groups and torture in Iraq while he was head of the Multinational Security Transition Command there, which was, of course, training Iraqi police, military, and commando units.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, I want all that forgotten history, but first I want to stay on ridiculousness of the media that won't report any of this. My theory is it's because they don't know any of this, because they spent the entire Iraq War years saying, well, you know, it's the good guys versus the terrorists, without doing the slightest bit of study, right? Without reading Bob Dreyfus once to try to figure out who the hell was who over there. And so all they know is, yeah, Petraeus, he was a general over there, and then he was a general over there some more, and then he got promoted to greatest general ever and won it for us. But they don't know anything about it at all,
right?
Do they?
No, they know very little. They basically sit and read, you know, they read the press releases, and they rewrite that, and they report the news, and that's it. It's astounding the laziness, the corruption, really, of the United States press corps to a large, though luckily not complete extent. After I am talking to someone right now who's trying to get information out, but it boggles my mind. It's not, of course, just on General Petraeus. It's on everything from the run-up to the war in Iraq, the lies, the torture, you know, the war in Afghanistan. Petraeus is just one instance of the lack of curiosity and the follow through by the press on the true history of David Petraeus and his career is just one example of how awful the U.S. press has been.
All right, now, I think he's famous. He really came to prominence as the leader of the surge. Fred Kagan and the rest of the neocon crew. People might remember, right, it was after the midterm election in the fall of 2006. The Democrats won both houses of Congress. It was seen as a widespread repudiation of the Bush policy, and they had the James Baker Commission that recommended wrapping this thing up by 2008, if you can, please. And Bush decided to double down and go with the surge and put Petraeus in charge. Actually, I said too much already, though, because what I wanted to say was before we get to that kind of history that begins in, you know, I don't know, January 07 or whatever, the part of Petraeus' story that people are more familiar with, I want you to tell us about the couple of years before that and some of what was revealed in the WikiLeaks about his role in the death squads and at least the outsourcing of torture in the Iraq War.
Right. Well, we don't have a smoking gun that says I order torture or I order Petraeus' signature on anything that says that he wanted death squads. They, of course, don't work that way. But, you know, it's pretty simple to put the pieces together. Now, before Petraeus was the savior for the Bush administration and surge in Iraq, which, yes, we should get to and realize was really just a public relations stunt that cost at least 1,000 American lives and an untold number of Iraqi deaths. Way back, not long after Abu Ghraib revelations had taken place in 2004, it would appear that the U.S., and by the way, at the same time, revelations were taking place about the publication of the Ubaidi, the torture memos. They're also coming out at that time in the Washington Post. So some kind of change had to take place where they could hide the torture. And what they did is they created a policy which WikiLeaks exposed, a Fragmentary Order 242 in June of 2004, the same month that David Petraeus was put in charge of the training of all Iraqi security forces from the coalition side. And this Fragmentary Order 242 stated that if U.S. or coalition forces were to discover instances of abuse of prisoners, torture of prisoners by Iraqi forces, they were to ignore that.
Right. And now this, if I remember right, this led to a confrontation between Donald Rumsfeld and...
Right.
I'm trying to remember. It was Tommy Franks. At the time, right? Because Rumsfeld, someone asked at a press conference, and Rumsfeld said that, well, you know, if the Iraqi government's soldiers are torturing people, that's none of our business. And Frank said, no, I'm sorry, Mr. Secretary, that is not correct. We are obligated to intervene and not allow that. And it was right there in front of everybody, and they kind of went back and forth, right?
Yes, I'm sorry I don't remember the exact date of that. I wish I had that in my head. But either Franks was not read in, or he was just Rumsfeld hadn't realized that the cover story was to be that, of course, they wouldn't. You know, was to put forth a lie, in other words.
Yeah, hey, we're on TV, man.
Yeah, Rumsfeld, you know, way back in D.C., we didn't get the telegram perhaps telling him that he should lie, which is, of course, what the U.S. did all along, including Petraeus himself, of course, who claimed he never found any instances of abuse in detention centers in Iraq. Oddly enough, a New York Times journalist, or at least he was writing at that time for the New York Times magazine, Peter Moss, was in under Petraeus' regime of training of the security forces, which included the setting up of the notorious Wolf Brigade and other Shia-backed terror squads that executed a reign of terror in Iraq at the time, was present when one of Petraeus' primary deputies, a man by the name of James Steele, was in the room with the head of all the police commando units, Admin General Pappett. And while they're sitting interviewing General Babbitt and James Steele, there's screams from the other room of torture. So James Steele has to get up and go into the other room. Whatever he said or did, the screams stop, and then they go on with the interview. Of course,
I'm sorry, Jeff, your phone went a little silly on us right there. Can you rewind just one thing? They were in the room. They heard the sounds of torture outside, and this guy Steele had to go out there and shut him up?
Apparently that's what he did, because when they shut up, and then he came back in the room to continue the interview. James Steele was, who was Petraeus, is one of his primary advisors on this counterinsurgency experts, actually. Who was also working with him and the Ministry of the Interior, Iraq's Ministry of the Interior, had come years ago, kind of wet his or burnished his credentials on this kind of stuff when he was working with special forces units in El Salvador. And, of course, what Petraeus and the U.S. military in general came to implement in Iraq, which was the use of domestic forces, terror forces, and the organization of death squads, mass arrests, terror, and torture came to be known, in fact, as the Salvador option, because that is what the U.S. has done before. And they certainly did that in El Salvador. And, in fact, we now know some of the same personnel showed up in Iraq.
And again,
it's part of Petraeus's team, but you'd never know this. That was mostly reported in the British press, although Robert Carey may have reported that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the first time I saw the published term El Salvador option for Iraq, I believe was a Newsweek story from early 05, if I have that right. And the whole theory was that, well, these local Iraqis know who to kill. We need to decapitate the different Sunni-based militia resistance groups. And so if we hire the Wolf Brigade to do it, they'll know who are the right guys to get for us. And then the Wolf Brigade being, you know, I guess the special forces of the Badr Brigade, right? The Badr Corps of the Supreme Islamic Council that basically became the army. And then these are the guys who were putting drills through people's eyeballs to death is how they were, you know, so-called cleansing Baghdad of Sunni Arabs. And then this is where the surge kicks in, right? Is that was already winding down, and Petraeus just came in to help finish giving the Sunnis the double tap in 2007.
Right. Well, there were two things, a number of things were happening before the surge, but even prior to that, the U.S. Army was already starting to pay off Sunni leaders. Of course, the way that the Sunnis, who had been subjected to this terror regime starting back in 2004 in their neighborhoods in Baghdad and other cities, Mosul, Samarra, they turned or found themselves turning to their own version of counterterror in the so-called Al-Qaeda elements or Mujahideen, or they developed their own terror squads. And there was sectarian violence on both sides. And this is where the Al-Qaeda elements, we don't know, it's kind of shadowy exactly who they are, were also involved in terror. But the U.S. Started giving money to the Sunni elders and the tribal leaders, et cetera, and the different towns to pay them off not to use these guys and to turn them in. And they called this the Sunni Awakening, or the, you know, in Anbar province. But really, it was they were paying out tons of money, billions of dollars, were poured into Iraq that no one can account for, that was often used to pay off different elements. And so that was one thing that was happening. Another thing was that the Mahdi army, Mukhtar al-Badr, who ran that, had decided for his own reasons to call a ceasefire at that time. So there were a number of elements that was already in place when the surge happened, you know, so that Petraeus had nothing to do with. And then he claimed the mantle of some kind of success for this. And then later, of course, tried to implemented the same strategy in Afghanistan with disastrous results.
Right. Yeah, that was the whole thing, right, is because the surge working was really, and I think they admitted this at one point anyway, that this is really all about buying time for the Washington clock, never mind the Iraq clock. But we just want to somehow convince, you know, relieve the pressure, the political pressure in D.C. to wrap this thing up and figure out a way to stay a little longer. So the surge worked. It was really all just a PR stunt for Madison Avenue rather than anything that was really happening. I don't know Madison Avenue specifically, but you know what I mean. Rather than anything that was really happening on the ground in Iraq. In fact, before they even started paying off the Sunnis to turn on the Al-Qaeda and Iraq fighters, they already were turning on them anyway because they're a bunch of suicide bombing crazies. And they were conscripting people and cutting people's hands off and outlawing women buying cucumbers at the market because we all know what that's shaped like and whatever. And the local Iraqi Sunnis were like, no, we're in charge of this thing, not you. You're here to help, if anything. And since you're abusing your privileges are revoked. And that was going on. We were covering that at antiwar.com from the beginning of 2006, like almost a full year, like 10 months or something, before the surge even began in the beginning of 2007 and Petraeus came in and started paying them off. So the Iraqi Sunnis were already sick and tired of Al-Qaeda guys. You know, they were already marginalizing them themselves. And also, they'd already pretty much lost Baghdad. So it was sort of like, hey, let's regroup and not all just die since we, you know, just lost the civil war basically already. You know, that was the way Patrick Coburn explained it. Well, the thing had just burnt itself out by then anyway.
Yeah, a lot of it by then had, you know, people had, just, I mean, just, there had already been thousands of murders and decapitated corpses and, you know, war fatigue was setting in. And the Bush people and the neocons, they wanted to go out looking like winners, right? Yes, yeah, so, you know, we have a surge, we pour in the troops, it's a big battle, we win. If how, you know, one remembers way back, what was it, 2003, when Bush went to the battleship and said, you know, mission accomplished. Well, they wanted to say it again. Mission accomplished. Iraq was a good war. Of course, Iraq was a total war crime. It was an aggressive war. Everyone implicated in it in pushing it at high levels anyway is a war criminal. They prosecuted an aggressive war. This, you know, whether it was the international military tribunals in Tokyo after the war, where Tojo was put on, in fact, executed. You know, high military officials, or in certainly in during Nuremberg, high military officials were put on trial for prosecuting aggressive war, and they were executed or sent to long, long prison terms. But that, of course, doesn't happen in America. In America, you know, generals like Petraeus are, you know, lauded as you were saying earlier, as someone really special. And their crimes are covered up. And instead, when they fall for, you know, some kind of sex scandal.
Yeah. Well, and what's funny is, you know, aggressive war and all considered, they don't even face the shame at all. He's still a hero anyway, right? Never mind the current scandal. They never had to report the truth that they lost. I mean, they themselves, it wasn't me, they were the ones that made up the benchmarks where they were going to get all these different groups to compromise and start working together in the parliament, and they were going to pass a pro-American oil law, and they were going to have 56 bases and be invited to stay in preparation for whatever next war we wanted and whatever, and they didn't get any of that. And the government that they fought for, just like we told them all along, was much better friends with the Iranians next door than with us, and they kicked our asses right out of there. Now, who's our friend in Iraq? Al-Qaeda in Iraq, who David Petraeus, at the head of the CIA, I'm sorry, I'm skipping Afghanistan here,
yeah, please,
Petraeus
yeah.
of the CIA was funneling these guys into Syria to fight against Assad up until last Friday.
Right, right, yes. Well, I mean, the U.S. has turned to Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda predecessor type going back to to Jimmy Carter, in fact, and Zbigniew Brzezinski in 1979, when they began funding these types of individuals in Afghanistan to fight, even before, by the way, before the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, but to bring down the, at that time, pro-Soviet Afghan regime. There were no, this was prior to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So, you know, and they've certainly used Islamic fundamentalist forces at various times, you know, over the decades. And so the fact they're doing this now is not surprising. American foreign policy is extremely cynical, very much rooted in realpolitik and the, you know, divide and conquer policies. And so you use what's at hand. Today, You're my enemy. Tomorrow, you're a freedom fighter.
Right. Well, and again, there's a lot of stupidity that goes into it, too. Like, they all believe this guy's hype about the surge working in Iraq, where they're like, let's pretend, give him an extra year in time to do it, and let's pretend that he really did help the Shiite majority win the civil war and kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad, and that was all to his credit or whatever. Well, still, there's nothing like that situation waiting to replicate itself in Afghanistan. Still isn't. But in Afghanistan, we're fighting for the minority coalition that was on the eve of complete and total defeat when we intervened on their side. And everybody knows that no matter what, Surge accomplishes this, that, or the other battle, you know, against the Taliban, that when we leave, the Northern Alliance torturers that we put in power are all going to have to flee. Because everyone in Afghanistan hates their guts, and most especially the Pashtuns.
Right, yes, because of this, the minority, you know, a lot of the politics in that area still is sectarian, ethnic, tribal politics, and they don't like, you know, the Pashtun majority, or plurality anyway, doesn't like being ruled by Tajiks and others from the north. You know, it's, one thing I wanted to point out here is, by the way, is that after Petraeus left, his job is training the police, you know, commandos and the torturers in Iraq. His position was taken by a guy who today is Barack Obama's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, who took over the same policy of turning people over to be tortured. You know, in the period of time between 2004 and 2009, that includes both Petraeus and General Dempsey's stints as being in charge of this multinational security command, almost 200,000 Iraqis were detained in Iraq, right, which was actually as much as 2% of the male population. And
the army eventually admitted that 90% plus of them were wholly innocent. The army said that, not just the Red Cross.
Right. Well, whether they're innocent or not, nevertheless, whether you're innocent or not innocent, you're not supposed to be tortured. And yet, thousands of these people also were tortured, and the U.S. knew about it. And it's a war crime to turn people over to forces when you know that they will be tortured. That's a war crime. In fact, it's a war crime that the U.S. itself signed off on when it signed the U.N. Convention Against Torture. Back in the very early days, well, signed it under Reagan and ratified it in the very early days of the Clinton administration. It's just a stand, and by the way, this wasn't just something in Iraq. Petraeus at that time, certainly in 2005, was not in Afghanistan, but in Afghanistan, also the same policy was put in place that U.S. NATO forces were to begin turning prisoners over to the Afghan National Security Directorate, despite the fact they were known to be torturing prisoners. This caused a lot of scandal among coalition allies like the Canadians, the Dutch, and the British. But, of course, in the U.S. press, you almost never read anything about it.
Right.
And this continued up through the Obama administration. Under the Obama administration, in figures I was able to find, at least in 2010, almost 10,000, at least 9,000, I don't know the exact figure beyond it, but I know that at least it was reported over 9,000 prisoners were returned by the U.S. military and turned over to the torturers in the Iraq prison, even though their own State Department and news accounts were reporting the torture was taking place. But nobody hardly reported that. That was a fact I found as a little footnote in a Bureau of Investigative Journalism report.
Yeah.
So it's just astounding. The crimes just continue. They continue under the Obama administration. Petraeus is a particularly egregious example. And his fall certainly will not upset the Obama administration probably very much after the initial scandal blows over, because you know, he's a leftover of the Bush years. But, you know, it's hard to know. Maybe Obama identifies so much at this point with the you know, the military goals and worldwide goals of the U.S. military industrial security establishment that this will blow over, and Petraeus will be seeing him on Fox News as a commentator.
Oh, yeah.
Very near future.
Oh, yeah. No, there will never be any accountability on TV for who did what. And by the way, I got bad news for you here. You know, the Obama administration has, of course, been fighting in court, and they just won in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in a torture case where these guys were American citizens, whistleblowers on a military contractor during the Iraq War, who then, as they tried to escape the country to come home to America in order to blow the whistle, they were captured by the military and tortured. And the judge just ruled that, hey, you know, Donald Rumsfeld and everyone under him, and including the men who did the torturing, they all have complete immunity. And after all, it's unfortunate, but torture is part of human nature, or something like that.
Yeah.
The article's at news.antiwar.com. These men have complete and total immunity and impunity for anyone that they feel like torturing, because they are who they are.
Yes.
And that's Obama's position, and he's winning in court with that position right now.
Yes, he certainly committed himself and with his war against whistleblowers in general. I guess one of the ironies, I believe Marcy Wheeler, who you had on earlier in the show, or if she pointed that out, I apologize for repeating it, but you know, whereas Petraeus just only weeks ago was crowing about the prosecution of John Kiriakou.
We didn't talk about that. Go ahead about that.
What? No. Just a piece of irony there that, of course, just to point out the Obama administration's war against whistleblowers and to come to the defense of those who have tortured. By the way, there's one other thing I wanted to say about Petraeus. He also was intimately involved in this case that I did write an article about, on a slightly different note. I didn't mention him, but, this was the case of, the U.S., resident, Iranian, used car salesman Mansour Arbabsiar, who was recently, pled guilty to supposedly an assassination plot against a Saudi Arabian diplomat. And, of course, Petraeus was reported as, and this is in a story I just read today by Robert Perry, I think it's Consortium News, I'm not sure where he published it, you know, noting, but I guess it had been published before, it was Petraeus who was pushing this assassination plot by Iran.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and I recommend people go read Ray McGovern about that at the time, too. He wrote about the Petraeus angle big time on that. And he's also a Consortium News guy.
Yes. Well, you know, well, the problem with that plot, of course, despite the fact that Arbabsiar has now pleaded guilty and is going to be sentenced, is that the guy had been examined by some of the top psychologists, psychiatrists in this country. The guy who actually was in charge of the DSM, for your listeners out there, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 4, that is used by all the psychiatrists and psychologists in the country, said that Arbabsiar had a severe psychiatric disorder. In fact, he was bipolar, and that he was mentally ill, and that his testimony and his statements to police while in custody without, of course, an attorney, and his supposed waivers of that, were invalid. The government went and brought in its own experts, so-called experts, including a guy who had done a hit piece on the anthrax case, and also one of the top DIA, CIA, it's hard to know, psychologist, whoever she is, Susan Brandon, who was actually covertly researching this case, who was watching the entire interrogation of Arbabsiar by closed circuit TV, submitted a report to the court that was then sealed. No one has seen this. That supposedly within days helped lead to the case being shut down and Arbabsiar pleading guilty. We don't know what that was about. All we can say is that Petraeus was not alone in some kind of strange covert behind the scenes workings along with DOJ. Right. Of Justice on this, maneuvering towards war with Iran. My point in mentioning all this is these are very dangerous individuals, and I am not sorry to see Petraeus go, but I am sorry that because he is a dangerous man. But this is I'm sorry still, though, that, it, you know, your show, of course, accepted, and some other commentators and writers, that for the vast majority of Americans who listen to the mainstream media will have no idea of the kind of crimes that are being done in their name and the kind of people who are running the U.S. military. It's really a shame.
Yep. Yeah, you're certainly right about that. And, you know, I don't know. It's really just like anything else. If anybody's ever been interviewed for an article about their local bake sale or anything, you know that reporters get it wrong. But, you know, if you ever met a reporter, they might have even impressed you as someone who was really ambitious but not necessarily that well-versed on what the hell's going on in the world. You know, I mean, come on. Why should they be right? Why should anybody give them the benefit of the doubt? Why should anyone think that a general is, you know, perfectly clean at, oh, it's at that one time that, you know, the human heart, what are you going to do?
Right.
That kind of thing. But other than that, this is the most exemplary individual in America. I just hate to think that that myth will stand. You know, I got to do my little part to chip at it, you know, whatever I can.
Right.
Now, there's one more thing, by the way, we didn't touch on, which is, at least according to the Washington Post, almost the entire analyst side, intelligence side of the CIA has just been turned into a drone targeting system. And, you know, here this guy wants to do nothing but add more and more and more drones. And I don't know if you saw this, but at the American Conservative blog today, Phil Giraldi is saying there's rumors. He's saying it's just speculation, but there are rumors going around that it was guys in the CIA that helped push him out the door because they don't like him, despite what you might have heard. They don't like him, and they don't like the way he's militarizing the whole place. And he says something like, they just, yeah, it's pro forma to not like a former military guy coming to run their agency. You know, they just don't like that sort of thing. They never did take too kindly to him, so I guess we'll see how that angle plays out, you know? Whether there were, he calls it a CIA coup, right? Question mark, right? Not for sure, but...
Well, it is true that I'm not sure we really know. I know Marcy's on this and other people trying to figure out how this all came about, and a narrative is forming around these emails to, you know, another woman, and it went to the FBI. But actually the Daily Mail reported in the UK that it was another American intelligence agency that brought this problem or this issue to the head of to the FBI rather. And you know, I don't know if that's true, and I don't know. It's possible that a clique within the CIA, perhaps utilizing its counterintelligence functions to protect its own agency, discovered this and got the ammo upon which to bring down Petraeus.
Giraldi writes here, he's seen it happen before from inside the agency where the staff of the place decided they didn't like the new guy and they succeeded in getting rid of him. So, I guess.
Well, they did that to John Deutsch some years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of them that he cites. And then Max Hugel back in 1981 was going to be the director of operations under Casey, and they bucked, apparently, and it didn't work.
Yeah, it's, you know, the behind the... you know, the public persona of or image of the CIA and the military as well. These institutions are really racked by clique infighting. And, but these aren't, it's not that, I think it would be a mistake to think that behind it, some kind of principled politics or principled position such as killings are wrong, you know, and therefore we're going to bring down Petraeus.
Yeah, no, it's right there in Federalist number 10. The best you could hope for under a system of government like this is that ambition can be made to check ambition, and that all these guys will fight among each other for their own personal gain so much that the rest of us will be able to hopefully skate by unnoticed.
Yes, that's a great quote, Scott. That's a great quote. Oops. Yeah, that's that really expresses what's going on here. So it's kind of, you know, what I'd like to see, and I'm glad that, you know, you're doing this show, is because we want to look beyond this kind of circus that's put out there as, you know, as political discussion in the mainstream press about, you know, oh, who said what, oh, how many women, how many emails, did he love her, where did they have sex under the desk, and all this kind of shit. Oh, pardon me.
Nah, go ahead. It's fine.
And get to the underlying issues. Why should that be more important than the fact that thousands of people were tortured under a program that was implemented by David Petraeus? Why is that never mentioned? Spencer Ackerman put out a huge mea culpa article at Wired saying how he was duped by Petraeus. it was kind of nice that at least somebody in the press noted, took back and realized that he had allowed himself to become too close to his material. But never in that article is there really a discussion of Petraeus' war crimes. And in the end, he still takes on the what a shame that a great man was brought down this way. So the idol had clay feet, but we shouldn't criticize him too much. He did do good things too. Kind of attitude. Totally not a word from Spencer, who also used to write for Fire Dog Lake, but now is over at Wired. And of course, he was at the Washington Independent. Sorry. But anyway, not a word from him about Paragraph 242, about Petraeus' role in helping organize the Wolf Brigade, et cetera. Nothing. So this is the way of the world now. And it doesn't appear to be getting better in terms of the political fight in this country. Apparently, this also means taking on the mainstream media. Yeah. I hate to say.
Well, yeah, see, and you're killing me because when you said, yeah, we'll see him soon on Fox, and boy, I just have too visual an imagination for that. Of course we will. Of course you're absolutely right, and we'll be stuck with him forever, right? The guy's still only, what, 60? So
yeah.
Forever we're going to still have to deal with these guys. And, only the good die young and the evil live forever. He won't be off TV till he's older than Kissinger or something, this guy, with
well,
all
it's
his
like,
expertise
yeah,
and his PR.
Right. Or Oliver North is really a key example of a guy who, did the America's dirty work for it and got caught. Of course, Petraeus really wasn't caught for this in the sense of there being Senate hearings. When he was up to be, as I point out in my story, The Forgotten History of David Petraeus, when he was voted on as CIA director, the vote was 94 to nothing. 94, not one person raised the kind of issues that we've talked about here today.
It's amazing.
That is the sign. I mean, when the same kind of thing would happen in Stalinist Russia or today in Politburo in China, the U.S. goes ape shit, talking about how there's no democracy. But really, if you look in the mirror here in this own country, you see that, in fact, the same kind of stuff happens. And no one, by the way, has ever... The same thing happened when Martin C. was ratified as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Not a word about what had happened in Iraq with him. Nothing.
Right.
And when I dared write something about it myself, I had emails back from some military types who claimed to be critics within the military, trying to defend Dempsey and trying to get me to be quiet about this kind of stuff. So, it really is... I mean, no harsh pressure was put on me. I don't want to put that out there. Mm-hmm. But definitely there was some pushback about even any critique, no matter how remote, about the people in power now.
Well, maybe instead of the dean of Princeton or whatever, he should go and open up a firm on Madison Avenue. Your repeated use of the term shit reminds me to make sure and take a moment to personally attack this son of a bitch's character because he doesn't have much of one at all. Obviously, here he is stabbing his wife in the back right in front of everybody, and maybe with two chicks. I guess we'll see how that worked out. But the thing I wanted to point out was just what a craven suck-up he was, as revealed by this accidental email exchange. There's an anti-Israel activist named James Morris, people might remember. Petraeus went to give some testimony, and part of his written testimony, I don't know if he wrote it or his staff wrote it or whatever, but it said, Israel and their perpetual occupation and abuse of the Palestinians is hurting us, and it's making our interests in the Middle East harder to deal with, et cetera, like that. And then, so James Morris wrote an email to Petraeus saying, hey, congratulations for finally telling the truth about that, kind of snarky way, I guess. And Petraeus responded by sending a link to a Max Boot article saying, don't be mad at Petraeus, at Commentary Magazine, by the way. Don't be mad at Petraeus. Mm-hmm. He didn't mean that. He didn't write that, and he didn't say it. It was only in the written thing, and he's okay, and don't be mad at him, everybody. But what he didn't realize was he accidentally forwarded on his email exchange with Max Boot, which all had him sucking up in the most craven way to Max Boot, who, if people don't know, he's a Weekly Standard guy, a neo, you know, one of the, I guess, the head neocon at the Council on Foreign Relations now. And he's saying, please don't be mad at me. Please, Max Boot, tell everybody, not the Israel lobby and the neoconservatives, please don't be mad at me for saying that. I didn't mean it. Someone else wrote it, and little cute smiley faces and everything. It's the most contemptible thing, and people can read it about that at theamericanconservative.com today as well.
Yes, yes, and Petraeus definitely tried to fault, I believe, on that whole, oh, I didn't really say this, you know.
Oh, and I spaced out Jeffrey, and I ruined my whole joke. Was your use of the word shit reminded me, first of all, of Gareth Porter's reporting about Patrick Lange, former CIA guy, said that Admiral Fallon, who was the head of CENTCOM when Petraeus was running Iraq, called him an ass-kissing little chicken shit. The kind of guy that David Hackworth would have called a perfumed prince, a political general who never got his hands dirty himself in his whole life, but knows just how to suck up to a Democrat, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you have the craven sucking up to Max Boot. That's what I meant to say, but I screwed it all up. Sorry.
But no, that's fine. And by the way, Petraeus obviously had his enemies within the Pentagon as well. And it's not without possibility for those who are looking at such things to wonder whether or not the intelligence agency, as the UK press put it, that originally sent this to the FBI, didn't originate within the Pentagon itself, say the DIA, for instance, or the NSA. You know, the NSA, who scoops up every single email that's sent by anybody. And, you know, maybe he has some enemies over there. Hard to say. The American, to really peek in, into the deep heart of, dark heart, really, of American politics is to look at some of the most sordid ways of interacting that you could possibly imagine. And, so I don't know that we'll ever know the truth about Petraeus. In terms of what brought him down now, was it the people who hated him for being a chicken shit? You know, or was it, I can tell you this, though. It was not somebody who had a principled position that the kind of war crimes this guy was involved in meant that he should be brought down. In fact, people who are very well aware of the kind of crimes he did, such as Dianne Feinstein, who's the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said she felt really sorry that Obama had accepted his resignation. Well, he should have been made to stay on. So these are the kind of people who are running. This is the Democrat. These are the kind of people who are, running politically our society. And it's really quite frightening when you think about it, because they have a massive amount of money and weaponry, and they can pretty much do whatever they want. With the only limitation being, of course, reality. And that's what they found in Iraq, where they essentially lost the war in Iraq, or at least were stalemated, might be a more proper way to put it, and had to withdraw, as you were pointing out, without winning all their objectives, or many of their objectives. And, the story is not over in the Middle East yet by any means, and obviously now they've switched to trying to destabilize Syria and clean up the mess they made in Libya.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that'll work just fine. All we need to do is surge on in there, and whoever's running the CIA next, they'll do a brilliant job of picking out who are the good guys to arm and who are the bad guys not to, and it'll be great. Just like all the rest of them.
Right, right, exactly. Well, you know, in many ways, the rise of Al-Qaeda was the blowback from their massive, support to and arming of Islamic, fundamentalist terrorists. Really, in Afghanistan, to fight, and of course they labeled them freedom fighters then, and then later to turn them into, the people to replace the dark empire of Ronald Reagan, the evil empire of Ronald Reagan, to now be the cause for which America is spending itself into bankruptcy to carry a bloated military and its CIA and intelligence apparatus. I don't know how many intelligence agents we have now.
But still, only in Afghanistan and Yemen and Somalia, because in Libya and Syria, there are friends. And in fact, and people can just do the Googling, too. There are Afghan fighters who've said, you know what? We rather fight on the side of the Americans in Syria than against them in Afghanistan. And so they're going to Syria. Our enemies in Afghanistan are leaving and going to Syria to fight on our side against the Baathists. And that's what's going on there right now.
Well, for the Syrian people, for the Afghanis, the sad truth is that their leaders like this, or the Al-Qaeda types or others, are just as cynical and as prone to political maneuvering for their own gain as anyone else. The only difference between them and the U.S. is that they don't have a world empire. And they don't have nuclear weapons. But if they did, they would operate just like the U.S. They're just as cynical. They're not really there to help people. You can see, you know, it's not like the Taliban is an enlightened alternative to the United States. It's a very sad, extremely sad fact that there's almost no one over there for these people. And the U.S., you know, all we can do over here is point out the role of the U.S. in making this all worse. Far worse than it would have been otherwise. And it, of course, muddies the water so that whatever progressive forces could come to the fore in countries like Syria or Afghanistan are neutralized by the fact you have imperialist intervention against those countries. And they always make sure, by the way, that the first groups to be neutralized are on the left, right?
Yeah, so, or even anybody with glasses, you know, anybody who not only read a book but was considering writing one, something like that. That's who the CIA gave a list of all the literate to Saddam Hussein to kill back in the days.
That's right. Yes, and
back in the 60s,
and they were certainly applauded. Back and applauded if, in fact, they didn't assist on some level when Hussein rounded up all the members of the Soviet Allied Iraqi Communist Party and jailed or executed them all.
Yeah. Well, this is why they got along so well with Pol Pot, was because they're just like him.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Right. So, you know, they have, their primary goal is always eliminate the left, destroy the secular types, you know, it's like Mossadegh, destroy the secular nationalists. And so they know that they can cut a deal, just as they have with al-Sadr. They can cut a deal with these other types who and that's what they do, and if the others, they eliminate.
All right, everybody, that's Jeffrey Kay. You can find what he writes at truthout.org and at Fire Dog Lake, where the latest is The Forgotten History of David Petraeus. Thanks so much for writing this and all your great work, Jeff, and your time on the show.
And thanks to you, and the same for all your great work, Scott.
Appreciate it.
Hey folks, Scott Horton here for Veterans for Peace at veteransforpeace.org. I'm not a vet, but if you are, I'd like to ask you to consider joining Veterans for Peace. As you know, in matters of foreign wars, a veteran's voice is given much more weight. Well, Veterans for Peace is making veterans' voices heard in ways and places where they can really make a difference. There are more than 175 chapters of Veterans for Peace in all 50 states, working hard to eliminate nuclear weapons, seek justice for veterans and victims of war, and abolish war as an instrument of American national policy. It's the peace vets versus the chicken hawks. Join up the good fight at veteransforpeace.org.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here. After the show, you should check out one of my sponsors, WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by Mike Swanson, a former hedge fund manager who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Mike's site, WallStreetWindow.com, is unique in that he shows people what he's really investing in, updating you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike's betting his positions are going to go up due to the Federal Reserve printing all that money to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. In an empire where Congress knows nothing, the ubiquitous D.C. think tank is all. And the Israel lobby and their neocon allies must own a dozen. Well, Americans have a lobby in Washington, too. It's called the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
They advocate for us on Capitol Hill. Join CNI to demand an end to the U.S.-sponsored occupation of the Palestinians and an end to our government's destructive empire in the Middle East. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit, Dagny & Lane, at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount.